It's the Happy Gang.
Opportunity knocks.
Gilmore's Albums.
The Royal Canadian Air Force.
I'm Mr. Sinclair.
Good morning, I'm Peter Zosky. This is Morningside.
The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Hello, I'm Michael Enright. Welcome to Rewind, the archives program here on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Radio 159. Today, the year 1965 on CBC Radio, a sort of portrait in sound of a year. You'll hear music, news, drama, and talk that give a flavor of what a CBC listener would hear on any given day in 1965. In the 1965 Committee on Broadcasting report, the CBC was criticized for favoring television over radio. Quote, "This is a waste of both public assets and individual opportunities," it read. To counter the growing popularity of TV, the 1965 fall-winter CBC radio schedule aimed for balanced programming, offering a little bit of everything, giving Canadians an alternative to what the CBC called incessant rock and roll or wall-to-wall music. Now, on this program, we'll give you a taste of that variety. For example, you might start your listening day with Alex Trebek reading the news.
Good morning. Here is the CBC National News, read by Alec Trebek. First, the main items. The Inter-American Peace Force, led by U.S. tanks, occupies the rebel zone in Santo Domingo. Prime Minister Wilson is due to arrive at Salisbury shortly for talks with Prime Minister Smith on the future of Rhodesia. Almost 1,000 candidates file nomination papers for the November the 8th election. Now the details. American tanks and troops of the Inter-American Peace Force in the Dominican Republic this morning occupied the rebel zone in Santo Domingo as tension in the city mounts. Edward Scott reports from Santo Domingo.
United States Army tanks led the Inter-American Peace Force into the so-called rebel zone of Santo Domingo just before dawn today, and U.S. and Latin American troops occupied the entire...
And that's this edition of the National News from the CBC Radio Newsroom in Toronto.
Alex Trebek went on, of course, to host the game show Jeopardy. At the time of this newscast, Trebek, who had joined the CBC in 1961, had gained a reputation as a broadcaster known for his poise and composure. After the news on a weekday in 1965, you could tune in for the Max Ferguson Show, a series of short satirical sketches, or perhaps Music on the Heather, a program of Scottish music. And at lunch, there was a 15-minute show with Tommy Hunter and his Rhythm Pals. The Tommy Hunter Show aired on CBC Radio between 1960 and 1965, after which it moved to television. And just before 1 o'clock, you would hear the official time signal.
Now for the National Research Council official time signal. The beginning of the long dash following 10 seconds of silence marks 1 o'clock, Eastern Standard Time.
In November 1939, CBC Radio began network broadcasting of the Dominion Observatory official time signal. Generations of CBC Radio listeners have set their watches and clocks to the familiar daily refrain aired promptly at 12:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The announcement introducing the time signal has changed very little since it began. The official time signal is the longest-running feature on CBC Radio. After lunch in 1965, you might have tuned in for the debut of an entertainment show featuring the storyteller and musician Gordy Tapp. It's introduced by my old friend, Alan Maitland.
Shakespeare said, "Love comforts like sunshine after rain." John Selden said, "Marriage is a desperate thing." Gordy Tapp says,
"Marriage is a lifelong process of finding out what kind of man your wife would have preferred to marry."
Here's a chance to look on the bright side of things with the music of Phil Nimmons. Wit and humor by...
Who?
Gordy Tapp, that's who. Hey, that's a heck of a way to start a new show, you guys. Come on, you're making me feel terrible.
Oh, wait a minute, Gordy. We're only kidding. Let me give you a proper introduction. Theme, Phil, please. Who's the nicest man we know?
Gordy!
Who's the star of a brand new show?
Gordy!
Who's the man with zest and flair, filled with charm and savoir faire?
Gordy!
Well, now, that sounds a little better. Now, what
Who's
I'd like
the to... man we think is great?
Gordy!
Oh, gee, fellas.
Who do we appreciate?
Gordy!
Who makes us laugh until we're tired, and if we don't, we'll all get fired.
I knew it was too good to last. Thanks anyway for those kind words. Al, there's one thing about your introduction. You forgot something.
First show and everything, eh?
That's right. Mm. You forgot yourself.
Well, I'm a very modest guy. I got a modest part.
You got a lot to be modest about. let me do it, will you? Ladies and gentlemen, our golden-throated announcer, Al Maitland.
Who?
Al Maitland, that's who. Now, cut that out. Ladies and gentlemen, Gordy Tapp.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Let me say hi, neighbors. You know, we're starting a new show, and there are a few things we'd like to get straight, not only with those in the cast, but everybody, because we're living in a pretty wonderful country. Canada is. I mean, where else in the world are there elections every year? all our politicians are campaigning right now, and we have had so many elections lately in this country that they've mimeographed their speeches, and they're going to use the ones from last time this time. They're thinking of installing permanent polling booths in schools and farmhouses. I think it's a good idea. The issues are pretty straightforward, though, and if anyone knows what they are, will they please ring this station? The leaders of both parties would like to know. Nowadays, with all the elections, you don't tell your kids about birds and bees. You tell them about the pros and the cons. But there are three things that the Canadian voter has. That's faith, hope, and apathy. Of course, the people get a little confused at election time with all the speeches and so on. Do you know that in the last election, there were 350,000 votes cast for Earl Cameron? You know, and a lot of sportsmen and personalities are getting into politics. There's Red Kelly, the hockey player, Whipper Billy Watson, the wrestler, Joel Aldred, the announcer. And out in the West Coast, George Murphy's running for senator, Ronald Reagan is going for governor, and Steve Allen is getting involved, I understand. It'd be very funny if the politicians started to get into sports and show business. Can you imagine things at Maple Leaf Gardens going like this? At the face-off, it's George Hees to Leon Balsay. There's a hard body check by the chief, and here comes Ray Alcoet. He's skating on thin ice. That's usual. Or, ladies and gentlemen, from Studio 7, we present the swinging world of Lester B. Oh, boy, confusion. That is politics. Who knows? Juliet may be our next prime minister.
The Gordy Tapp Show on CBC Radio in 1965. Tapp later hosted the CBC television show Country Hoedown and went on to perform and write for the CBS television show Hee Haw. I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to Rewind, the archives program here on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Radio 159. Today we look at a typical programming day on CBC Radio in 1965. After Gordy Tapp, it would be mid-afternoon, and you might be in the mood for something a bit more serious. Trans-Canada Matinee might fill the bill. Pat Patterson was the host of this long-running series that featured interviews, book readings, and segments such as Matinee Quiz. Here's Matinee in November 1965.
It's Trans-Canada Matinee. In this half hour, a look at a fascinating example of international cooperation as historic monuments are moved to make way for the Aswan Dam. A conversation with comedian and ad man Stan Freeberg and a sampling of his comic creation.
A remarkable piece of international cooperation is the work now going on in the Nile Valley to cut out the colossal statues and temples of Abu Simbel from the living rock and re-erect them higher up so they won't be submerged under the waters of the Aswan High Dam. Film producer William McQuitty, the man who made the film about the Titanic disaster, A Night to Remember, has just published a lavishly illustrated book about Abu Simbel. And in London, Jack Singleton asked him to describe the scene.
I first approached the temples across the Nile, a distance of about half a mile, in just before the sun came up. And at first, there's a haze on the river. And then as the sun rises, it cuts through the haze and the temples emerge almost magically from the tall sandstone cliff in which they're resting. And as one grows nearer, the perspective changes, and instead of looking at them from a horizontal position, you're looking up at them, which I think was the way the Egyptians intended them to be looked at.
How high are they?
The actual temple itself is 100 feet high, and the four colossi are 65 feet high. And there's a little strand in front of it. You've got the milky green water of the Nile, the yellow strand, and then a few thorn trees in green, and the temples in this beautiful soft red sandstone, and then high above, maybe 200 or 300 feet higher, on the cliff top, the blue sky. It's a most majestic setting, and it's a great pity that this had to be lost. That is one of the reasons why I was determined to put it in this book as a record of what they were really like.
There are two temples, aren't there?
There are indeed, and most unusually, Ramesses II built the second temple to his favorite wife. Now, he had 111 sons and I think about 57 daughters. He must have had innumerable wives and concubines, but Nefertari was his favorite throughout his life. She was also his daughter, of course, and he built this temple for her, and it is only maybe 150 feet away from his own temple.
Nefertari means beautiful companion, I learned from your book.
That is correct, and she must have been not only beautiful, but had her head very well screwed on, because the competition for his favors, he lived to be 97, must have been quite remarkable. The intrigues of that court would, I imagine, be equal to anything we've ever seen.
And these colossi in front of the temples are of Ramesses himself?
Oh, indeed, yes. Even in front of his favorite wife's temple, Nefertari, he has seen fit to put up four huge statues of himself and only two of his wife.
How old are the temples?
Well, the temples, well, they're over 3,000 years old. I think that the beauty of them has been preserved because of them being covered with sand. The other figures in the Nile Valley, like the Colossi of Memnon, have been almost obliterated by the blast of desert sand throughout the years. But these have been safely covered and were only really uncovered a century ago. And the Egyptian craftsman, he really knew stone. He felt the stone, he loved it. He only had very primitive instruments to cut it out with. And most of the work he had to do by pounding them with harder stones, wearing them down like that. The name of the sculptor sometimes was put on the statue, but very often it became obliterated. Ramesses was a very vain man, and wherever he saw a good-looking statue, he usually erased the owner's name and put his own on instead. In fact, in our own Cleopatra's Needle in London, he's written his name on it in four or five places.
Everybody wants top billing. Film producer William McQuitty talked with Jack Singleton in London.
Pat Patterson on the program Trans-Canada Matinee in 1965. The Aswan High Dam was completed in 1970. 1965 was also the year that the musical Anne of Green Gables first came to the stage. It had first appeared some 9 years earlier on CBC television and was adapted for theater for the first season of the Charlottetown Festival in 1965. Elwood Glover was a regular on CBC radio and television. He started at the CBC in 1938 as one of six staff announcers and went on to work here for the next 35 years. One of his best-known programs was Luncheon Date, a program that started on radio and then moved to television. He also hosted At Ease with Elwood Glover, which was a Toronto afternoon drive-time show. Then the news, and after that you might tune in for Assignment, the precursor to As It Happens. It was launched in 1956 and billed itself as People Radio. One of its many interviews in 1965 was with Walter Cronkite, a reporter extraordinaire and anchor of the CBS Evening News, a position he held between 1962 and 1981. Here he is with Bill McNeil.
Walter Cronkite is one of the best and most respected newscasters in North America. Best known for his series 20th Century and You Are There, Cronkite is seen also every day by TV viewers on his national news telecast. He's the anchorman for his network on elections, on space shots, or anything that spells importance or drama in the field of public affairs. On a visit to Canada, I asked him about one of this century's top news stories, the Nuremberg war crimes trials, what he gained personally from them as a reporter.
It gave us all an insight, I think, into the Nazi mind that we didn't have at the time we were actually trading bullets with them. One of the most fascinating parts of the Nuremberg trial was to sit there some 15 or 20 feet from Hermann Goering over a period of nearly a year and listen to his recounting, as well as those of his 20 colleagues, on the building of Nazism and what they thought it meant.
Did you form any personal opinions of these people?
Oh, very definitely. Although we never exchanged any words, a certain sort of a strange rapport was built up in the courtroom there. As I say, we sat in the press box some 20 feet from him. He sat on the end of the group of defendants. And we exchanged looks occasionally because, in a sense, although we were certainly the belligerents, as far as he was concerned, we were members of the press. We were, in a sense, neutral observers. He'd trade looks with us and wink and grimace occasionally. And we kind of got a little rapport with the guy. No respect for him, obviously, for his beliefs, but some respect for his intellect.
Walter Cronkite has covered the top news stories on every continent. What for him were the most exciting?
Well, of course, in our generation, my generation, there isn't any way to answer that except World War II. There isn't any story such as a world war, obviously. If you take in that area of the war itself, then you have to weigh a lot of factors, and I'd find it pretty hard pressed to answer, I suppose. Probably the first Flying Fortress raid on Germany, the first V-2 attack on London, or V-1 attack, actually, I suppose, when the buzz bombs came in there and we first began to know what they were.
Who was the most fascinating person you ever met?
Winston Churchill, most fascinating man I ever met, because I knew what he stood for and knew his background, and as a person he was a fascinating individual. There are a lot of them who are part villain, part hero, or some of them all villain, all hero. I think that Senator Joe McCarthy was a fascinating person.
Undoubtedly.
Fascinating from the standpoint of what he stood for and the kind of man he was. I think that some strange little men like Anton Mussert, who was the Quisling of Holland, was a fascinating man because of the circumstances under which I found him. I was the first to interview him when he was being held in a back room in Amsterdam. He protested that he was not a Nazi throughout an interview, and then as I began to leave the room, he just couldn't help himself. He clicked his heels and gave me the Nazi salute, and he looked terribly embarrassed as I slammed the door on him.
Well, he certainly was a fascinating man. Walter, I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk to me.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's been a great privilege and an honor to be with you on this program.
Newsman Walter Cronkite, an assignment personality.
Walter Cronkite in 1965 on the program Assignment. I'm Michael Enright, and this is Rewind here on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Radio 159. The fall of 1965 saw a federal election, and two young future prime ministers took part. One of them was Joe Clark, 26 years old and already deeply involved in Conservative Party politics. Here he is on the show that was new to CBC Radio that year, Cross Country Checkup.
In effect, then, from CBC Edmonton, we, with fingers crossed, introduce Joe Clark.
Thanks very much, Brad, and I'm naturally pleased to bring light to the darkness. I agree with Tony that there is one central issue in this campaign, and it is generally that the Prime Minister and the Liberal backroom boys are trying to sneak this election past the Canadian people. They called the election when it was neither needed nor wanted, and when it would deny the vote to thousands of young university Canadians. But no recent federal election has been more important, especially to younger Canadians. We are moving as a nation from an old way of life to a new way. And the central question in this campaign is which party is best suited to govern the new Canada. I am an active conservative because I deeply believe that the Conservative Party alone possesses that innovating spirit which a growing nation needs. We proved it in office. Even the critics applaud the progressive new conservative policies in agriculture, in justice, in social justice, in trade, in vocational training, in other areas. And now we want to move in education, in urban development, in resource development. And the liberals, by contrast, want to sneak into office. Canada can't afford another old guard government, and especially the young can't afford it, because we will live here the longest, and we have the most to gain from a conservative government on November the 8th.
Thus the progressive-conservative perspective on this current election.
Future Prime Minister Joe Clark in 1965. In the election a month later, Lester Pearson's Liberals fell just short of a majority. But thanks to three wise men, Jean Marchand, Gérard Pelletier, and Pierre Trudeau, Liberals triumphed in Quebec. The Liberals had wooed prominent Quebec Labour leader Jean Marchand to run for Parliament, but Marchand would only agree if the party accepted Trudeau and Pelletier as candidates as well. The Liberals were reluctant at first, but eventually found ridings for all three candidates. Future Prime Minister Trudeau was also somewhat reluctant about his entry into politics. He turned up for a crucial 1965 pre-nomination meeting with Liberal organizers, quote, dressed in an open-collared sport shirt, a suede jacket, a beat-up old peaked hat, muddy corduroy slacks, and sandals, according to one biographer. He was sent home to change into something more suitable before the meeting began. Listen to this interview with Pierre Trudeau on the night of the election.
With me is Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the winner in Mount Royal. Mr. Trudeau, the Liberals did very well in Quebec, but they didn't do so well in Canada. What's your opinion on the outcome so far?
Well, you're asking me now. I haven't seen the results too well. I just come from my riding, and I wish you wouldn't ask me too much about things I don't know, unless you want to explain me what the results are.
Well, it looks as though the Liberals are not going to get a majority, the majority that the Prime Minister was looking for.
Oh, well, I'm sorry for that. I think the Liberals, had they had a majority, if they do have a majority, will be able to show the kind of strength at Ottawa which is needed now if we want to keep Confederation steady, if we want to have a government in Ottawa which can negotiate with other nations and with the provinces, knowing where it will be sitting the next day. But that is a might have been now. If this isn't what is going to happen, I still think that the Liberal government can do a darn good job in Ottawa, and I'm sure that all of us will be fighting to see that this job gets done. And I think the onus will be on the opposition now to try and defeat any laws which we think are urgent for the future of this country.
Mr. Trudeau, it was said that at one time that you were probably going to run, if you did run for the NDP, you're running for the Liberals. Why?
Well, if this was said, it is wrong. I was never in the New Democratic Party, though in the past I have supported at various times various political possibilities. I did support in 1963 the New Democratic Party. I did support in 1962 the Liberals, and in 1960 the Liberals. So really, I, from the outside in the past, I have taken a different stand according to the political situation at the time of that election. At the time of this election, I have decided that not only I would support or vote for the Liberals, but I would join the Liberals and help them make the kind of fight that I thought essential for this country.
Pierre Trudeau on the eve of his first election win in 1965. Trudeau refers to the question of why he had run as a Liberal. That came up because in 1963, Trudeau had campaigned for a close friend, the NDP candidate Charles Taylor. The same year, Trudeau had vocally attacked Pearson, calling him the unfrocked priest of peace for permitting nuclear warheads on Canadian soil. However, Trudeau's relationship with Pearson improved greatly over time. He wrote in his memoirs, "I learned a great deal from my time working with Lester Pearson, although our styles were very different." In October 1965, a new program billed as Lively and Controversial Radio for the Mind made its debut on CBC Radio. The hour-long daily program was called The Best Ideas You'll Hear Tonight and was billed as a series of talks, discussions, and commentaries for people who just enjoy thinking. The very first series was about Darwin's theory of evolution.
Ideas.
Scientific ideas.
Literary ideas.
Ideas from the social sciences.
Ideas from the fine arts.
Good ideas.
The best ideas you'll hear tonight. This is Ideas, beginning the second week of the new look in CBC Educational Broadcasting. I'm Ken Haslam, your host for Ideas, an hour each weekday of Radio for the Mind. Idea number one for Monday, Charles Darwin's Theory of Evolution. These programs follow Darwin on his voyage of discovery in 1831, the development of his ideas and thoughts into a carefully documented theory of evolution. In later programs, we'll hear some modern theories based upon the original idea. Our guide on this radio voyage is Dr. June Clare, a biochemist and former science advisor for Britain's ITV network. And with Dr. Clare each week is Ideas science editor Bill Whitehead. And here they are now to continue the story.
Next morning, we saw the sun rise behind the rugged outline of the Grand Canary Island and suddenly illumine the peak of Tenerife, whilst the lower parts were veiled in fleecy clouds. This was the first of many delightful days, never to be forgotten.
This is how Charles Darwin described his first sight of land after sailing from England in HMS Beagle in 1831. For Captain Robert Fitzroy, the object of the expedition was to survey the coasts of South America, compile charts, and carry a line of meridians around the earth. For Darwin, taken on a ship's naturalist, the little vessel was a laboratory and training ground. He set out with a mind both inquisitive and receptive to what he saw. His lack of formal education gave him an unspoilt and fresh outlook. No detail was too trivial to escape attention. He made detailed notes of all he saw, so that, at a later date, he could connect facts and details noticed at different ends of the world.
Darwin collected innumerable specimens, but because his cabin was small, he sent most of them back to England. His friend Professor Henslow at Cambridge was soon flooded with bits of rock, dried leaves, and old bones, arriving from various exotic corners of the world. In a letter written from Brazil, Darwin outlined his plans. "I think, if I may so soon judge, I shall be able to do some original work in natural history. I find there is so little known about tropical animals."
As it turned out, he did a great deal of very original work. But the circumstances under which he worked were far from easy. The Beagle, a brig of 235 tons, was not a comfortable ship. Everyone was cramped for space. And Darwin was repeatedly seasick. Indeed, every time the sea was rough, he retired to his hammock. To make matters worse, he also began to have pains in his side, the first signs of an illness that afflicted him all his life. Often he regretted the easy-going manner in which he had set sail. Had he been any older, Darwin might never have stayed with the voyage for 5 years. Probably he would have taken advantage of the captain's oft-repeated assurance that he was free at any moment to leave the ship. He could, said Fitzroy, board a ship bound for England, or be put ashore in some safe, healthy country. But a healthy country was hard to find on the shores of South America. As for homebound ships, they were few and far between.
When Darwin wasn't working on his notes or specimens, he looked for companionship. The sailors were a dull lot. Darwin hoped that Captain Fitzroy would become a friend. He didn't. When they first met in London a few months before the voyage began, Fitzroy was 26, 4 years older than Darwin. He ran his ship with temperamental brutality. One moment he was tolerant. The next he ordered flogging all round. He was a man, Darwin thought, who was as much a bully as Nelson or Napoleon, but without their better qualities. Fitzroy kept things moving by having rows with everyone in turn. If the crew put up with his bad temper, it was only because he was a good sailor and understood the ways of the sea. Fitzroy's temper, Darwin wrote, was a most unfortunate one. This was shown not only by passion, but by fits of long-continued moroseness against those who had offended him. His temper was usually worse in the early morning, and with his eagle eye he could generally detect something amiss about the ship, and was then unsparing in his blame. The junior officers, when they relieved each other in the forenoon, used to ask whether much hot coffee had been served out this morning, which meant, how was the captain's temper? He was also somewhat suspicious and occasionally in very low spirits, on one occasion bordering on insanity.
This veritable Captain Bligh considered it mutinous if anyone disagreed with him. Several times during the five-year cruise, Darwin and Fitzroy had heated quarrels. Their outlooks were totally different. Darwin was an ardent Whig, Fitzroy a Tory. Political discussions were therefore taboo. Not that this was too great a hardship, for with increasing distance from home, political issues seemed to fade in importance. Religious issues were more fundamental. On this the two men also disagreed, and as the voyage went on, Darwin had to suppress his growing doubts about the validity of certain concepts. But it was about the South American slave trade that Fitzroy and the naturalist had the most violent rows. At one point, Darwin thought he would leave the Beagle.
Early in the voyage, he wrote, at Bahia in Brazil, Fitzroy defended and praised slavery, which I abominated. He told me he had just visited a slave owner who had called up many of his slaves and asked them if they were happy and whether they wished to be free, and all answered no. I then asked him, perhaps with a sneer, whether he thought that the answers of slaves in the presence of their masters was worth anything. This made him excessively angry, and he said that, as I doubted his word, we could not live together any longer. I thought that I should have been compelled to leave the ship, but as soon as the news spread, I was deeply gratified by receiving an invitation from all the gunroom officers to mess with them. But after a few hours, Fitzroy showed his usual magnanimity by sending an officer to me with an apology and a request that I would continue to live with him.
Near the coasts of Tierra del Fuego, Darwin noted the great lumps of seaweed. Unlike the land, these marine masses were full of life.
A great volume, Darwin said, might be written describing the inhabitants of one of these beds of seaweed. Almost all the leaves, excepting those that float on the surface, are so thickly encrusted with corallines as to be white in color. On the leaves also are patelliform shells, uncovered mollusks, and innumerable crustacea. On shaking the great entangled roots, a pile of small fish, shells, cuttlefish, crabs, sea eggs, starfish, flatworms, and a multitude of other forms all fall out together. Often, as I recurred to a new branch, I never failed to find animals of new and curious structure. If any forest were destroyed, I do not believe nearly so many animals would perish as would here from the destruction of the seaweed.
Each day, the young naturalist found some new species, rock formation, or exotic flower to delight him. Not only the scientist, but also the poet in him, was fed by unimagined beauties. Happier aspects of the scenery made an indelible impression on him. In his letters home, he marvels over and over again at it. Early in the voyage, he wrote to his father.
From Tenerife to Santiago, the voyage was delightful. I had a net astern the vessel, in which I caught great numbers of curious animals, and fully occupied my time in my cabin. On deck, the weather was so delightful and clear that the sky and water together made a picture. Nobody but a person fond of natural history can imagine pleasures of strolling under coconuts, in a thicket of bananas and coffee plants, and an endless variety of wildflowers. I find to my surprise that a ship is a singularly comfortable place for all sorts of work. Everything is close at hand, and being cramped makes one so methodical that in the end I've been a gainer.
Even the cramped quarters and the bad-tempered Fitzroy were nothing compared to the joys of this part of the journey.
From November 1965, some of the first series of The Best Ideas You'll Hear Tonight. The name was shortened to Ideas the following year, and of course, remains so to this day. I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to the Archives program Rewind here on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Radio 159. Today, a look at a programming day in 1965 on CBC Radio. By now, we're into the evening, and after Rod and Charles, a program for children, there was RPM. Its host, Bob McGregor, looked at news about automobiles. And in 1965, one of his stories might have been about the brand new Auto Pact. In January of that year, Prime Minister Lester Pearson and President Lyndon Johnson signed a limited free trade agreement that was formally called the Canada-United States Automotive Products Agreement. The agreement signaled a marriage between North America's auto industries, in essence making Canada and the United States one big car-making country. Listen to this clip from Prime Minister Pearson.
Well, Mr. President, I share completely your satisfaction as we are able today to sign this automotive agreement, and this is one of the most important accords ever signed between our two countries in the trade field. As you say, we face a very difficult situation in this particular area of industry, and through hard work, patient negotiation, we have concluded an agreement which is a benefit to both countries. This wasn't accomplished easily, and it couldn't have been accomplished at all if there had not been that mutual understanding, goodwill, and confidence which has grown up between our two countries over the years. Mr. President, I have said to you many times, and you have said to me many times, that there are no problems between our two countries which can't be solved if we work at them hard enough and in the right spirit.
Prime Minister Lester Pearson in 1965 about the newly signed Auto Pact with the United States. Simon Reisman, who was with the Canadian Department of Finance, negotiated the 1965 Auto Pact. 20 years later, Reisman was chosen by Prime Minister Brian Mulroney to head the Canada-U.S. free trade negotiations. Later in the evening on CBC Radio, you could listen to a concert. The program Monday Concert was one of numerous programs devoted to classical music on CBC Radio. In October 1965, it featured Yehudi Menuhin, the world-renowned violinist, in his first appearance with the Winnipeg Symphony Orchestra. He played a Brahms violin concerto under the direction of conductor Victor Feldbrill. Here he is in an interview prior to his debut talking about what inspired him to become a violinist.
I will always remember my first impression of the Brahms concerto for violin when I heard my great master George Enescu play it several years before I first met him in Paris. It was in San Francisco, and if anything could have confirmed my desire at that time to become a violinist, it was his performance of this majestic concerto. And he looked the role, too. He was a leonine man, very powerful, with a mane of longish black hair, which also rather stirred my imagination. I don't imagine that I will give the same impression tonight, though, and that probably doesn't only depend on the color of my hair, but I hope the concerto carries the same impact.
Yehudi Menuhin on the program Monday Concert. From high culture back to pop culture. In 1965, William Shatner, before he was better known as Captain Kirk on Star Trek, was just another young Canadian trying to make his mark in the U.S. In this interview, he's talking about his television show called For the People.
Tell me, do you find that it means a lot more work, this kind of regular thing, or is it less work than doing an equivalent amount or a comparable amount of stage work or one-shot TV acting?
Well, naturally, working every day from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, learning some 70 pages of script a week is an enormous amount of work. These are good scripts that we're getting. I'm getting a chance to do a lot of things. I'm observing many of the finest directors in the business at work. I watch a script being developed from a storyline to a shooting script. I sort of have an inside track in every phase of the business, all of which I'm interested in, not just acting.
Do you have much time to get up to Canada these days?
I flew up to Montreal a couple of weekends ago. As a matter of fact, an amusing thing happened on my way back. I flew back on a Sunday night, due to arrive about 7 o'clock in the evening, which would give me ample time to get back home to watch the show, which is on 9 o'clock Sunday evenings. But the plane was stacked up over Kennedy Airport, and by the time it landed, it was 9:15. And I was desperate. I wanted to see the show. I hadn't seen this particular segment, and So I rushed over to the airline's official, and I asked him if there was a television set available, and he said, no, there wasn't. The only one available was in the lobby that everybody was looking at. So at 9 o'clock, I was out in the lobby looking for the television set, and there were a group of some 80 people watching Channel 4. And just as I arrived, Bonanza was just going on. So I grabbed the official, I said, change that channel to Channel 2. And he got up there and he changed the channel to Channel 2. And 80 people and myself watched this show for the people. I had a captive audience of 80 people while I sat with my sunglasses on and my coat collar pulled up around my ears so that nobody would recognize.
Without even taking a vote.
Without even taking, had they taken a vote, we might have had better ratings.
Well, tell me, did they like the show? Did they enjoy it?
Well, I didn't hear any screams of anguish.
Well, that's great. Maybe they hadn't seen it before.
That's right.